Blog Talk Radio.
Can anybody out there hear my voice? Does anybody out there really care for a missing child?
Good evening. You are listening to Voices for Justice tonight, October 27th, 2010. I'm your host, Michelle Bart, and tonight we speak with two victims, one a parent searching for her lost daughter, and the other a woman whose childhood was lost and taken. Two women, two completely different stories, and yet one path leading into the same direction, surviving the unthinkable. Our other guest will be psychologist Dr. Dale Archer. All of our guests will be taking your call shortly. The call-in number is 347-838-8622. The chat room is also open, and you can get to that by logging on to blogtalkradio.com/helpingheroes. Before we begin, if you or someone you know is being trafficked, please call the National Human Trafficking Resource Center at 888-373-7888. For other information, you can also visit Seroptimus International Northwestern Region's Northwest Coalition Against Trafficking at nwcat.org. Tonight, we welcome Dr. Dale Archer, the mother of missing woman Jessie Foster Glendine Grant, and we also welcome Dawn Schiller, author of The Road Through Wonderland, Surviving John Holmes. But most importantly, she is the founder of Esteem, empowering successful teens through education, awareness, and mentoring. Welcome, everyone. Dr.
Hi.
Archer.
Good to be here, Michelle.
Hi, Dawn. Are you there?
I'm here. Hi.
Okay, and Glendine? Do we have you on, Glendine?
Yes, thanks for having me.
Welcome. Welcome, everyone. Dawn, let's start with you. Your book is very compelling, and at many times while I was reading it, it actually even had me in tears. And even actor Val Kilmer, who played Holmes in the movie Wonderland by Lionsgate Entertainment, said, "Your book is a healing message for all women and girls in the world who have not yet found their strength. I'm proud to know her. Dawn's story is a miracle. She's a miracle." And today we do see a miracle in you, Dawn. But take our listeners back to 1976. You're 15 years old when John Holmes, who was 32 at the time, comes into your life. What happened next on your road?
Well, hi, and thank you for having me. I am very honored to be here. In 1976, when I was 15 years old, I was a kid with a father who was a drug addict. He was my only parental guardian, and he didn't really care. He had been absent for many, many years before that, came into my life suddenly. So I was a kid who was just really prime and for a predator or anybody who had ill will or what just wasn't above board to take advantage of. Much less, you know, I had no tools. I had no tools, plus I had, you might as well put a big red light over my head that said, this girl is vulnerable. You'll be able to get whatever you want and whatever you need from this girl because all you have to do is tell her that you love her or that she looks pretty or that she matters in some way that you don't even believe, and that you can take advantage of her on the other end. And that's what I was at 15, pretty much a kid that I call a throwaway because of the state of mind that I was in. I was in a condition, not that I ever think that anybody is a throwaway, but it was how I felt. I felt that I wasn't really cared for, that it didn't matter, that my thoughts didn't matter, and I was really just waiting. I was just existing and waiting to be shown a way to grow up. And at that time, John said, "I'll help you. I'll feed you," because food was something that we didn't have either. So he used those tools. He groomed me, and months later, he was able to have his way with me sexually and possess me later on to be his private secret from his porn world for the next almost 6 years.
When we talk about a lot of your book also shows obviously domestic violence, abuse, physical, mental, financial. October is National Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And to paraphrase, Paula Lucas, the executive director from the Americans Overseas Domestic Violence Crisis Center, regarding your book, she had to cry and hug her own children, desperately wanting to comfort the girl on the pages. And then she states that this book is an absolute must for teenagers and especially for the adults who should be safeguarding them against the evils in this world. Obviously, reading your book, we know that your parents and other family members, at least back then, let you down and were not safeguarding you. What do you feel the contributing factors in your life that led to the clutches of a predator like Holmes picking you under his thumb?
Right. Yeah. Well, for me, again, it was I had my parents divorced, but before that, the reason they divorced was because my father had just taken off. He was a Vietnam War vet who, after the war, just decided to leave our family in the lurches, and he actually stole from us, too. My mother worked many, many jobs and, again, was absent, and when she was home, she was bitter and she was angry. So when it came time for them to divorce, I had developed this illusion of my father being a hero, even though he really hadn't earned it in my mind, and I thought he was a safe place. But I was already in so much need to be noticed, to be regarded, to be considered an important member of this society, that I was looking for it anywhere that it would come, and I didn't even realize I was looking for it. I also feel like, you know, there was marijuana involved. There was, you know, my father had basically used us as pawns he had his own agenda. And so I was being, in a lot of ways, corrupted by my father. So I think that's a huge contributing factor to me, you know, that he showed me that it was allowable and it was okay to get high. As a matter of fact, he would have me roll joints before I went to school for him. He would have me, you know, we'd smoke joints together. I thought it was cool and funny, ha-ha, because my father was the cool guy. And, you know, wasn't it amazing? But in the end, it is something that left me very vulnerable and open to that condition of drug abuse and addiction.
What are some of the myths with what a lot of people know about John Holmes, or think they know? Some of the myths and truths behind Holmes and as a batterer, as a predator, that a lot of people have misconceptions of.
Right. What do I know about him? I know that what people think, when they hear my name connected with his name, they immediately think I must have been in porn, or that I must have been starstruck with this guy, and that I had, they assume that I was a runaway, which I wasn't. They assume that, you know, but I was definitely, I was almost abandoned. Even though my father was in the next house, I was abandoned by him as far as any kind of parental guidance was concerned. But they, you know, I wasn't a part of John's porn world, although he did end up trafficking me. So I think part of the myth that I think that is, needs to be clear is that I wasn't a willing member of John's society, his underworld society, you know, as maybe some people would like to guess that I was without knowing the story. The truth is he kept me hidden from that world and pulled more and more drugs and heavier drugs into it. He got involved with drug underlords. He did involve me with trafficking drugs. And then when he was so down and out, he kicked me out on the street and trafficked me on the streets of Hollywood in order to supply his habit. And he did end up selling me to Eddie Nash, who was a big drug lord, who was allegedly responsible for the bludgeoning deaths on the Wonderland Avenue house in Los Angeles. And he sold me into a brothel at one point by throwing me into the trunk of a car. So it's such a thin line to say that I wasn't in porn, but he did traffic me in a very secretive, predatory, evil, cruel type of way that almost killed me many times over.
Do you find speaking, I know that you go around and you'll be speaking at our Seroptimus Region Conference next year in April, do you find that speaking on human trafficking, much of what you're seeing today, especially you didn't have the internet back in the 70s, do you find that the trafficking ways that traffickers, pimps, boyfriends, whatever we want to classify them as, how they're operating today are different than what they were back then?
Well, they were definitely more sophisticated. But I think that the level of, I don't think that the idea of a trafficked person or the idea of being trapped into that world of, we call it slavery today, and bless people who are now, you know, acknowledging that, because in the, back then we were always saying, well, it must have been their choice. They must have willingly gone out and done this, and nobody really looks at all the factors involved. So we've gotten more sophisticated techniques and drawing in these kids. I think that there's a huge force that continues that glamorizes that world, you know, pimp your ride, pimp this, pimp that. It's a good thing to be a pimp. It's a good thing to be a hoe. All those things, as kids are growing up, they're listening to this, and they start to want to emulate that, especially if they are not being given a very solid groundwork for, you know, what is inappropriate and what isn't as they grow up. You really do have to pay closer attention, because it's almost everywhere. And now with the technology and in the internet, we're just infiltrated with it. We're just inundated with it. It's almost subliminal anymore, whereas before it was specific in different areas of media culture that we had available. Does that make sense?
I was very surprised and shocked to last year at Halloween. They had costumes on the market with a prostitute and a pimp. Costume, and I'm not talking for an adult. They were for six-year-olds, and I just gasped when I was shopping with my niece and saw that on the market, let alone seeing that the Targets and the Walmarts out there are actually selling that stuff. Responsibility has to start everywhere, not just with one individual, but I would hope that parents don't buy that stuff for their children thinking they look cute.
So keep that in mind,
folks listening.
Yeah. There's a huge level of people that don't understand that it's it carries some serious complications and consequences for a lot of people, and that it's not a laughing matter, and it contributes to the oppression that we already impose on women and girls, you know, for as far as looking at them as objects, you know, for sex. And as gross as this may sound, one of the things when John was beating me to make me go out onto the street, he would tell me, "You're sitting on $1 million." Now, what kind of human being says that to another human being? It's disgusting.
Let alone somebody at your age. You had mentioned placing blame. Glenn Dean, I wanted to ask you, your daughter Jessie Foster went missing on or around March 28th through April 3rd, 2006, from North Las Vegas at 21 years of age. Do you feel that law enforcement and those that you're entrusting to find your daughter are letting you down because they're placing blame that she may have gone on her own, you know, to Vegas? Can you tell us a little bit about Jessie's story?
Oh, certainly. Thank you for letting me share Jessie's story. In April of 2005, Jessie was taken on a trip down to Fort Lauderdale in Key West, Florida. And it is the typical take you on the trip, like they set you up in the movies. It's amazing how much it rings like a movie when I retell it. Then she came home and told me, "See, Mom, you were worried for nothing. You know, everything's okay." And then in May, she was invited on a second trip to Manhattan and to Atlantic City. And instead of bringing her home, they routed her to Las Vegas. And that was May of 2005. And by March of 2006, Jessie was a missing person. What we found out after she went missing was quite a contrast to what we'd been told. What Jessie had told us when she went down there, actually, I went and did it myself. I did what other people do. She didn't go down there. And I try to train people to look at the difference, and I just said it myself. When Jessie was taken there, she told us that she was going to stay for her 21st birthday, which was 2 weeks away. And then when the birthday came and went, and I asked her when she was coming home, because we're from Canada, and I asked her when she's coming home, and she said, well, we were in a car accident. My friend Yvonne and I were in a car accident, and so now we have to wait to do an insurance thing. She told us that a taxi cab ran a red light and hit them. And then after some time with that, she started telling us that she'd met a man, and then she was living with this man, and then she was engaged to this man, and this all happened, you know, in a very short amount of time. I had no reason to suspect human trafficking or anything other than what she told me, even though it did happen fast. You know, I wasn't comfortable with it all. Her down in the United States, me in Canada, you know, she doesn't know anyone else down there. And when she first went down there, I even said to her, you're not going to stay in Las Vegas for 2 weeks without me having any number except your cell phone number. I need another number from someone. And though I it wasn't a premonition, it was just me being the way I am, always worried, I said to Jessie, if you ever went missing in Las Vegas, where would I start looking for you? And so she gave me a number of the girl who she had gone there to see. I don't even know how she met this girl. Jessie grew up in Kamloops, B.C. We have a population of 80,000 people, and that has grown since she was little. Jessie didn't you know people who live in Vegas and all the sort of, you know, it didn't.
Right.
When she was in grade 11, she moved to Calgary and wanted to live with her dad for a couple years and graduated in Calgary. And it was Calgary, which is a large city, where she met the person who ultimately took her on these trips 2 years later. She met him when she was about 18. And then when she was 20, she was taken down. Then Jessie was allowed.
And this was a woman, correct?
The person who took her on the trips was a man, a Canadian man. The person that she was handed over to in Las Vegas was a woman. And this woman had, her boyfriend was a friend with the man that she ended up, I believe, sold to or given to.
Is that Peter
Todd? Or pulled off on. I don't know what term they use. But they gave her to him.
Is that Peter?
That's Peter. That's correct. Jessie.
And the last place that you knew Peter and Jessie may have been seen at 1009 Cornerstone Place, and he's the so-called boyfriend, I should say. Wasn't he married?
That's correct. He was.
How old was
married.
He? I'm sorry.
We got a couple different ages from Jessie because she knew I wasn't crazy about older guys for my girls.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so it started out at 34, and then it went to 39, but he was closer, I think he was 40 or 41. I believe he's 45 now. He was born in 1965.
Okay,
and,
yeah.
Jessie was 20 when she met him, so half his age.
And is he still behind bars for the arrest for battering?
No, that was before he met Jessie. That was on his wife before they were estranged and he was living with Jessie. After Jessie went missing, he did get arrested for selling drugs, and he did some time for that. In January, he got out.
What kind of drugs? Do you mind my asking?
At that point, I heard it was marijuana.
Okay.
So I don't know, you know, and initially I never believed that there was any kind of drugs involved because I just thought that I knew Jessie.
Right.
Now I know a lot more, and I believe that they likely, you know, got her on drugs.
And that's definitely a tool to manipulate and keep people trapped and
and fear of reaching out to authorities or any kind of help because they, you know, they say, well, now you're just an addict and someone, you're just going to end up going to jail or, you know, and who's going to help you?
And that's where the education on the police force needs and the judicial system needs to be done so that mm-hmm. the police recognize the girls as victims, recognize
right.
the pimps and the Johns as the ones who need to be arrested.
Right.
I don't know if you've heard about the Swedish way of doing
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
It's the Swedish model,
absolutely.
And I'm absolutely in favor of it.
It is. It's where it's not illegal to be a prostitute, but it is illegal to sell sex, to buy sex or to
buy
sex. Somebody sex for
yeah.
you know, selling
the Jones
sex.
The Jones are prosecuted.
Mm-hmm. Let me tell our listeners, mm-hmm. on the Jesse Foster case, you can log on to www.jesse, that's J-E-S-S-I-E, foster.ca. There is a $50,000 reward out for information leading to Jesse. My concern, or sometimes I ask the guests to submit some questions that I can ask them that I may not think of. And I was really taken back by a couple of the ones you sent me, Glendine, in regards to the police telling you, oh, it's a big desert, she's out there, she'll turn up one day. What agency told you that?
North Las Vegas. Detective Molnar, the police detective on the case. He told me a lot of things. He told me that she probably just got tired of us and ran away. But if that's not so, then she'll turn up one day because that's a big desert. And he's never once, he actually, even when I asked him to help me get some media in Las Vegas because I was from Kamloops, he told me that Jesse's case was not going to ever get media because it just wasn't interesting. But Jesse's case has got 4.5 years of media.
And unfortunately, a lot of the time that is true, not because of the interesting factor, it's because a lot of the time individuals, whether they're teenagers, young kids, or even 21-year-olds, if they're marked as a runaway or they're an adult especially, a lot of law enforcement will assume, unless there's complete evidence or some kind of evidence leading to them believing that they've been abducted, that individual in their mind may have been, they may have left on their own. We had a case in Tennessee similar to that. They never looked for Roger because he was an adult and they just assume he went off on his own. But, you know, sometimes the families do know the individuals a lot better than law enforcement believes. And I truly believe that, you know, all victims, and this is what I believe Jesse is, deserves some airtime and deserves to be looked for until they do come home. That was a horrible comment that somebody had to have told you. I can't even believe. Dr. Archer, are you on the line?
The detective, you know, I mean, the detective. He's been disturbed.
I want to go to Dr. Archer. He's a good friend of ours, and he is a clinical psychiatrist. Dr. Archer, you're listening to both Glendine and also Dawn. Tell our listeners a little bit about what it takes for somebody to do this to another individual and how these women in particular can survive such horrible, horrible crimes that they've both been through.
Well, first of all, I want to start off with just a few statistics here, just so the listeners understand exactly the scope of the problem that we're dealing with. And I think there's a misperception out there that human trafficking is only something that's going on in Asia or in Eastern Europe, and it's a big international problem, but it really doesn't affect America. Well, the stats are that about 200,000 individuals a year in the United States of America are subjected to this. And they don't understand the definition of human trafficking. Human trafficking is not taking a person from one country to the next. It is basically holding a person against their will and making him do things that they don't want to do. Of this 200,000 people, over 80% are women, and shockingly, over 50% are under the age of 18. So this is a monstrous problem, and one of the problems with the airtime phenomenon is that it's happening too frequently. There are too many people out there, there are too many victims, and the average citizen in this country has no clue, has no idea this is going on at
That's
all
true.
In any way, shape, or form. So I think that to put the perspective in the problem in perspective is the first thing that needs to be done. And with that being said, I do also want to weigh in on the drug aspect, because very often the human trafficking rings are also drug rings, because they are involved in the underworld activity. They are involved oftentimes in taking drugs from one part of the country to another, or from one country into the United States, and trafficking goes hand in hand with that. So the drug trade and the trafficking trade are just about nowadays one and the same thing. They definitely are hand in hand. In terms
Absolutely.
Of the individuals that do it, the motive is very, very simple. Money.
Money
is the prime motive. Estimates last year were that this was a $40 billion enterprise. $40 billion.
Speaking of money, today here in the Portland area, the Portland commissioners held their city council meeting, and they passed an ordinance that all of the items that pimps and johns get seized, all the funds from those items, whether they be cars or accounts or guns, et cetera, that money will be put into a fund for shelters for young victims of trafficking. So I think those little steps throughout this country will help definitely start to get a grasp on it. You mentioned Sweden, Glendine, and the state of Washington has one of the most stringent laws against trafficking right now, and that is they do prosecute the johns. If you're going to get caught, you're going to suffer the consequences, and I think more states need to follow suit. So it's ironic you just mentioned money, and one of our chat room individuals gave us the heads up about the city council meeting, which I found weird that during the public comment period, two pimps actually went up and said their piece about what if we're not having sex with underaged women. And I couldn't believe no media were in the room. So I'm hoping somebody picks up the sound bite from the recording of the city council meeting today.
I'd like to make a comment about the age.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to make a comment about the age. I think this is Dawn, and I'd like to make a comment about the age. I think when John started trafficking me, although he was obviously a predator before, but when he started trafficking me, I was 19 years old. Again, I was legally of age, and because he could coerce me in a way where I was not willing to go out and talk to other people, and they knew I was already over 18, I was really not flagged as anybody to help. I felt like I couldn't go to anybody, I couldn't talk to anybody. I was isolated from my family because he isolated me. He told me not to go, not to talk to them. They didn't care about me. They didn't, they were just going to turn me in. They were going to judge me, that I was ruined now, that I was nothing but garbage. All of these things that led me, kept shutting the door for me to ever walk out. And so when people at different times would see me, they would see somebody who wasn't really willingly reaching out for help, and she wasn't underage, so they didn't want to step in at that point when I was actually on the streets. So, I just want to say that although I'm very happy that we're raising awareness for the trafficking victims who are underage, I do feel like that magic 18-year-old number is just a crazy number. The human brain isn't even fully developed until the age of 25. Is that not right, Dr. Archer?
Well, I will totally agree with you. And again, 50% under 18, that means 50% are over 18. But
correct.
The methods that are used are the same in both situations. It's power
right.
and control. Of course, the drugs are used. But also, the victim individual in these cases typically, Dawn, is very similar to what you described. They come from a very dysfunctional family.
Right.
They typically are alcohol and drugs that are involved in the family. And they are basically looking for something better. They're looking for someone who cares for them, someone who will love them, someone who will show them attention. And these predators, the pimps,
mm-hmm.
they are experts at targeting
yes.
the women
yes.
that are going to be vulnerable in these
vulnerable.
Cases. They have it down to a science. And so
yes.
when they see a victim, they know. A little bit of attention, a little whining, a little dining,
yep.
saying I love you. That
yep.
sometimes is more than this girl or even woman. It doesn't matter whether
yep.
it's under or over 18, has ever
right.
heard in her whole life. For the first time,
that's
she
right.
feels like someone likes her, someone values
Here's
her,
here.
Someone is
yes.
willing to be kind to her. And
yep.
at that point, that means more than anything in the world. So that's how
yep.
it works. And
yep.
as you can attend, it's always okay up front. But as the power and control start to kick in, and once they know they've got you, that's when the downside starts.
Mm-hmm. That's the hook. That's the hook that was in me. I mean, I'd never had anybody give me a diamond ring before, and I mean, that was a diamond. I mean, it ended up, now that I look back with my adult lens, it was a diamond chip, but it was a diamond. Oh, my
yep.
gosh.
Yeah,
you know?
Absolutely.
May I say something also about this? This is Jesse's
yes.
mom.
Hi, Jesse's mom.
You know, Jesse, that's one way that they do get a lot of women, and I do fear because Peter's twin brother actually works in a school district and for a
mm-hmm.
school district and it makes me worry because I know that he'll be able to scope out the young women and girls just like you mentioned. But
mm-hmm.
what I really push to make people aware is, you know, Jesse came from a very loving family with a whole bunch of friends
right.
and he was
right.
beautiful and had lots of self-esteem and lots of boyfriends who wanted to date her and they still got her.
So I wanted to, yeah, I wanted to weigh in on that because
yes.
what I wanted to make the point, Glendine, is that Dawn's case and your case
mm-hmm.
are very, very different situations.
Mm-hmm.
And I gather
yes.
from the fact that you were appearing on the show and from the fact that you have not given up over these years
right.
and keep trying to find your daughter, which I applaud and think that you
right.
must keep doing every single day. But
that's
it's
right.
important to understand that this, even though, as a general rule, what I described is the way it transpires, I mean,
mm-hmm.
this can happen to anybody
Anyone.
At any time.
Mm-hmm.
All you have to do is make a bad decision with
a bad
the wrong
choice.
Guy
Back.
At the wrong time, and you are
mm-hmm.
in a life which you may not be able to get out of.
And that's exactly
right.
what happened to Jesse. Jesse, of course, thought of herself as very strong and independent, and I thought of herself as her, as, you know, barely being in her 20s, and she was just 20. So, you know, definitely she didn't have any age experience behind. And
that's
what,
part of it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It is, because she went out there
yeah.
thinking that she
right.
knew how to take care of herself, going up against people who that was their job. Their job
mm-hmm.
was to
exactly.
get you.
We have
and,
a...
Yeah.
We have a
Peter,
young
sorry.
Adult, has no... They have no tools. They have no tools to protect
None.
Themselves. And in my case, I had less than because I had came from a dysfunctional background. But it could be anyone, like you said, because it's
right.
it's the nature of being a teen. It's the nature of
That's
growing
right.
into,
you
much,
are
into
so
adulthood.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
And you know what?
But
even
you know, I'm going to take a
call right now. We have a call coming in from the Portland area. Caller, you're on the line. Do you have a question for our panel?
I'm a survivor that was trafficked in my 20s, and it's not the imaginary line of 18 really doesn't mean anything. And as far as sometimes you can come from what appears to be a really perfect family, and something still could have happened to you as a child that you never told your parents. And you may have blocked it yourself and that you don't even know it happened until you're 30 or 40 in therapy. And so there are all different kinds of ways around it. I was actually at the city council meeting today where it was actually two Johns who got up, and the first one got up and said, as long as I don't have sex with teenagers, I think it's unfair for you to take my car, which I thought was really strange that a John would get up and out himself like that on television and in front of city council, and then the other one was just kind of insane. But it brought the point to there are really, it's really not even a triangle. It's not just that there's pimps and johns and prostituted and trafficked women. It's also that there's those people who sit and do nothing about it, the observers. So many times we think it's a triangle, and it's really a square, because I applaud the efforts of the people of Portland who are currently raising awareness, because only when we raise awareness, we have these conversations, we have parent support groups, we have kid support groups. I just did a training for teenagers last week with 50 teenagers who now understand that using the word pimp is not a cool thing.
No.
And so we have to raise awareness everywhere we go.
Mm-hmm. And that could have been, I agree, I absolutely agree with you, and I think that that could have been maybe the culture, too, where Jesse was maybe more willing to listen to somebody who was talking about himself like he was a big pimp man, you know, because it was more socially acceptable. Whether she came from a really good family and support system there, she was still socially conditioned to accept those kind of people more and more.
She did, because she, you know, she liked the hip hop scene and dated a boy who put on shows, and of course that's all gangster rap crap in my opinion. And you're right, they do glorify it, and it has to change. I also go into schools, and I go with Crime Stoppers in Kamloops here, and we educate the students in the high schools about human trafficking, and I talk about Jesse, and I talk about how, you know, when Jesse, you know, Jesse just thought she was invincible and that she would know if anything was going to happen, and that if anything happened, she'd be able to protect herself. And, of course, we all know that's not true. And, you know, and the worst of what could have happened did. I find that I'm getting a lot of really good results. And actually now I was talking to the principal of the school Jesse graduated in Calgary in Alberta, and he's interested in us bringing the presentation there. So, you know. Well, what Canada has done is started a blue blindfold campaign, and that's come from the UK, where it's educating people on human trafficking, so we don't have that square. So we don't have people who don't see, you know, sex slavery or servitude or forced, you know, labor in construction. There's a lot of different ways that people are trafficked. You know, Jesse is trafficked, you know, for sex slavery, but there was a big case just in Ontario just probably 2 weeks ago where a human trafficking ring was busted, and about 8 or 10 men from Hungary were rescued, and they were being forced to work at a construction site. At night they were kept in a basement. They were fed scraps of food, and they were not allowed to go anywhere or talk to anyone. They had all their documents taken away, and all their money was kept to repay the so-called debt. The bondage debt is what, you know, holds a lot of people in place. They don't even know why or how much they supposedly owe these people, but they keep them until this debt is paid off. You know, and these men were rescued, and, you know, and then we've got the point of once they're rescued, what happens to them? Where do they go? How do they, you know, do these men want to go back to Hungary? Should they be able to recoup any lost wages that they didn't earn in all that time? I mean, should our government not step up and help these people go from being a victim to being a survivor? And then perhaps
I want to touch on that, Glenn Dean, since we do have two survivors on the line, and then our switchboard is lighting up, so I'll go to a couple questions in a few minutes from others. But with the two survivors on the line, Dawn and our caller, what is your take on shelters? Because we don't have but two in this country on the East Coast. We have beds that are identified for trafficking victims, but especially in the 70s, even your YWCAs and things of that nature that now can offer services to victims had no clue back then. So what is your take on the importance of shelters?
The shelters need to really, does the caller want to answer first? That's fine.
Me?
yeah.
I can. My take on shelters is that we're having this conversation currently here in Portland as we have a building and we have some money secured. is the shelter. There was a controversial conversation about the fact that, no, we can't lock these girls in. And the reality is if somebody who gets picked up knows that they're only going to be detained for 48 hours, that you're not going to get a very good chance of them thinking that they have any hope to change anything, because they know after those 48 hours are over, they're going back to their pimp. And
right.
So it needs to be a place that's secure so that they can start their healing process. You can't start your healing process in 2 days knowing you're going to go back to your pimp.
And the counseling they need is like a tenfold. You know, they need post-traumatic stress counseling, rape counseling. You know, there's more than one type of thing that needs to be helped with these women. It's
right.
Their whole life. They need to be retrained to get a job. They need to, you know, learn how to, you know, live on their own. And you know, so shelters are the best thing that could happen for victims.
Dawn, do you... Yeah, Dawn, you were going to say.
Well, you know, I was going to say too that that shelters do have to be, you know, they do have to be multifaceted in a lot of ways, and you have to be willing to see that door revolve a lot of times. And you have to have the specific training for these women. I think a lot of that revolves around choice. These women or girls maybe have never known, maybe have assumed this as a choice, but don't really know that they've ever had any other choice. So it's a matter of teaching them that there are other choices available to them. And I think that there's also the stigma of walking out knowing that you had been prostituted or that was who you were or what you did or something that happened to you a long time ago. How do you deal with that? You may feel like that's the only place that you're going to feel comfortable. I mean, it could be a lot of different things that they deal with. Melissa Farley does some really wonderful research, and she does a lot of prostitution research out of San Francisco and the healing and recovery, and she talks a lot about choice and how we perceive choice today. And she talks also a lot about the different models that are working with different, we're talking about the gay and lesbian and transgender community as well as, you know, anybody else. So shelters are, basically the very beginning. Please, you know, people who are there need to understand the conditioning that these women and girls and sometimes boys and men have been gone through, and to see that door as a revolving door.
Well, that's why they need to be educated.
Thank you, caller.
In high school.
Dr. Archer, when if somebody, let's take Dawn for instance, and any of the other survivors that we have spoken with or have seen at the conference, you know, 20 years goes by. Are you ever out of therapy, or from a doctor's point of view, the importance of therapy, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask, the importance of therapy when faced with this?
You know, the one thing I can tell you is that every case is different, and it's an amazing thing about the human psyche, in that you really can't predict going into a traumatic event such as trafficking or a natural disaster who are going to be the psychological victims and who are going to be the psychological survivors coming out. So it's a very interesting state of research that's being done on that right now. But I will tell you that what Dawn has done is she has done everything right. And by that I mean, in order to be a survivor of the psychological nature, you have to be active, you have to be looking to the future, and you have to be optimistic. The victims, by and large, are passive, pessimistic, and look to the past. And not only that, you have to have something to grab onto that is bigger than you are, a cause that you become a part of, to say, you know what, this happened to me. I am going to make it my goal in this life to try to do everything I can to make sure this never happens to another human being. And I think Dawn's book does that. I think her speaking engagements do that. I think everything about her life, basically, she's taken the trauma that she has suffered and turned it into something that is a good thing. And other examples would be Candy Leitner, the founder of Mothers Against Drunk Driving, who lost her daughter to a drunk driver. And then you look at John Walsh, who lost his son, Adam, to a sexual predator and founded America's Most Wanted. So that's what I do with my patients, is I talk to them about the optimism, looking to the future, putting the past behind, but also about finding that cause. And it doesn't necessarily have to relate to what happened to you, but something bigger than you are that you can grab a hold of and say, this is why I keep going. This is what my life is about, and this is what I'm focused on.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We have another caller on the line from 732 area code. Caller, do you have a question?
Oh, hi. Yes, my name is Deborah. I'm calling from New Jersey, and I just want to commend the ladies on the line tonight, and I just want to just briefly just say that I, too, am a survivor. I just want to say that I'm a survivor of domestic violence and sexual abuse at the hands of someone that was very close to me, someone that I loved and trusted to protect me, and that was my biological father. So I just want to let the ladies know that as a survivor, when it's that close at home, it took years and years for me to heal. My biological father not only gave me drugs when I was 15 years old, same age, and he taught me how to prostitute, and he was the one who ultimately landed me in prison. But today I forgive him. I am speaking out. I have too written a novel, and I continue. I won't stop until.
Is this Deborah Brown?
This is Deborah Brown Davis, yes.
Hi, Deborah. You're going to be on the show in December, right?
Yes, that's why I really didn't want to tell too much of my story, but I just want to commend the ladies. I'm
sitting back listening,
and I'm just overwhelmed, and it sounds like I'm hearing my own story. But the thing is, when it's your own dad, when it's your father, and someone that you trust and love, it takes a lot of getting over and a lot of healing.
Yeah.
And I want to throw in, Deborah, that, you know, we talk about human trafficking, but closely related is sexual abuse as a child, as you pointed out, but also domestic violence. Those all go hand in hand because many times you can be talking about someone who is being held against their will in a married relationship by her husband because the fact that she is being abused and she is being used. So all of these things are very, very much related. And I think it's important to point out that when we say human trafficking, we're talking about a host of problems from domestic violence to sexual abuse that all go into the mix.
Yes, doctor. He definitely had taken me from state to state. I've been all over the United States by him. And I was, and in these states, I didn't know anyone. So I had no one else to look up to but him.
Thank you, Deborah.
You're welcome.
Thank you, and we'll look forward for the listeners. Deborah will be back in December on Voices for Justice, and you'll hear her story, and I will have her link on our site as well. Thanks for calling in, Deborah.
Thanks. Thank you for listening, Glenda, and I just want to let you know I'll be praying for your baby girl.
Thank you so much, Deborah. Thank you, and I'll be
listening to your thoughts. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Deborah. Dr. Archer, we have a question in the chat room. This individual, she actually has bronchitis and can't speak, but she'd like to ask you about the discharging of trauma and how important you think it is to the reprogramming each one of these children so that they don't suffer from attachment disorders.
Wow. That's a complex question. I mean, it centers around the age of the child and the type of abuse that they were subject to. I mean, as a general rule, the younger the child when they're subject to a traumatic event, the more difficult it is for that child to go ahead and lead a normal life. And then in terms of the attachment disorder, that's a disorder that we talk about with failure to bond with a parental figure. And that typically happens in very, very young children from the age of birth up until about 2 years of age when they have no caregiver whatsoever, no one to bond to. Those kids are at the greatest risk of all in terms of being able to ever have any type of trust, ever being able to bond with another human being because of the fact that they never learned it at that very young age. So it's related to age, and it's related to the type of trauma or abuse that the child would be exposed to. So it would be a complex subject to be able to go into all of that, but that's in a nutshell what the answer would be.
Well, this individual says she wants to meet you. He's awesome, and I would, if you're listening, I definitely agree with that comment, and he's a great guy.
Thank you.
We wanted to go, say that again, doctor?
I said thank you.
We wanted to touch, we only have about 10 minutes, and I wanted to make sure that we got in a little bit of what else Dawn is doing, which I think is so awesome. She has started a STEAM, and it's kind of helping children more or less throw away teens, right, Dawn? What are the factors that why you created STEAM?
Well, my heart goes for the kid that was like me, a teenager who is floundering, is the prime target doesn't have the parental background that is not, by no fault of their own, is not a healthy one, a stable one, or even an existing one. I think that my motivation has been to just kind of, what could I do that could also would be some kind of solution? What would have helped me? And I think back a lot when I talk about, I've done a lot of research and I've created a presentation that I take nationally, and I talk about the throwaway teen being a condition that, a state of mind, a state of being like I was, and that, you know, people don't know that it exists. People don't know that it's going on there. I know the statistics out there for the trafficking, they don't know about that. They don't know about who's definitely walking around in their neighborhoods primed for other abuse, or, you know, to get into the wrong crowd, to end up being trafficked, to end up being homeless, to end up being, you know, addicted some way. But my goal was to, like, run around. I wanted to go and educate people on the fact that these kids existed, that they're the kids that I call the invisible ones. A lot of times, maybe they're doing things, they've isolated themselves, they're falling back out of school. There's a lot of reasons why they don't feel like they can be a solid human being in this society, and I wanted to educate communities. And what could I do? So mentoring. And I kept thinking, you know, in my research, mentoring was the real big answer that came up as something that we could do. I thought, well, you know, what programs were out there and how could we put on mentoring programs? So part of what I've done is develop a STEAM, empowering successful teens through education, awareness, and mentoring. To do those things was to go nationally, raise awareness on the condition of these kids, that their vulnerability, and how they needed communities to be there for them because they didn't have the opportunities to have parents to be there for them. And, you know, and have mentoring programs, mentoring events through schools and churches and community centers put on by local community members to have a day where they can teach them how to do something when, you know, or how to grow into adulthood, how to, if you want to be an artist, maybe is there something you can do with painting? If you want to write, is there something that you're creative or that you're good at? But I wanted to give them an idea of a light, of something that they could be once they did get away from the bad situation that they were in. I always say to people that in my situation, I was surrounded by adults who did nothing. And I want to agree with the caller who called in earlier from Portland, who said that, you know, that people, we need to educate the people who do nothing, because those people, just Jackson Katz says this best. He says, inaction is action. I'm sure he's not the first person to say it, but he's somebody who made me remember that. And I think that people need to know that they can do something. They don't have to just turn away like the adults did in my situation. I want to, through STEAM, we are organizing and reaching out and gathering information on how to tap into our website and copy and emulate a different mentoring program that you can bring into your own community. So that's in the process of getting built. We are also in the process of speaking out and being the information center for how to incorporate kids helping kids or peers helping peers. There's a lot of information already at the National Center for Victims of Crime, the teen advocacy area through the National Center for Victims of Crime has a great downloadable format where it's called the Teen Action Toolkit, where they talk about peers helping peers and getting that initiated in schools, doing 3 to 5 o'clock hotlines and listening to the other kids. But my whole point is that, you know, I always wish that somebody would have shown me that I could have been something else other than the battered victim of John Holmes. I always wish that somebody would have looked at me in another way that told me that I could have been something. And I think that my goal and my passion is to try and make this available to many others who are still reaching out and think they're nothing. They think they're worthless. And so the information is coming in. I'm still gathering it a lot. Right now I am speaking out and raising awareness and educating, but the mentoring part is still a great big part where I'm reaching out for other members to come in and to collaborate with and to get it organized. Medallion Press is my publisher. Medallion Press is amazing. I couldn't have been more blessed to have them be the publisher of my book. My book, obviously, with John's name attached to me, could have gone very salacious, very dark, very exploitive, and that was never my intent. My intent was to tell the story of what a kid was feeling and thinking as they were being victimized or exposed or molded in a way that they never really wanted to be. And Medallion Press really took this to heart as a message to be out there for people to understand who the kid down the block is, to get into the shoes instead of cast a judgment, to understand a little bit how they were thinking is maybe not as different as you were thinking when you were older. Only your circumstances were maybe better. And, to have more empathy. But they are involved with a company called, a foundation called Triple Threat. Triple Threat is a mentoring organization who is a great place I want to direct everyone to right now, because they mentor in the areas of academics, athletics, and the arts. And so very basically, you can separate different subjects, different categories, and have a mentoring day that's available to your community members, make it transportation available, free of charge, and have it volunteer-driven. You know what? We can do it, and we can have these kids, give these kids a little bit of light in a dark world that was not created by their choice.
You're definitely doing exactly what Dr. Archer had indicated, and that is giving back and doing something that you've lived and are able to empower and inspire our youth, and hopefully prevent anything that happened to you happening to them. I just wanted to let everybody know that Dawn's story, more in detail of the book and her journey with John Holmes, will be seen in the Portland, Oregon area November 9th at 11 p.m. on Coin Local 6, our CBS affiliate, when she sat down with Amy Frazier. And you'll hear more of her story. She'll also be the keynote, one of the keynote speakers at the Seroptimus International Northwestern Region Conference in April in Vancouver, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And more will be sent on Facebook about that.
Yeah, I'll also be at the North Carolina Governor's Conference for Women on the 9th, where I'll sit on the panel after Cheryl Wu Dunn gives her keynote address on women and oppression. And then I'll be in Denver at the National Women's Studies Association reading from the book. So I'm just, if you're in those areas, let me know. I'm on Facebook. I'd love to connect with you.
Wonderful, wonderful. And before we close tonight, I just want to remind everybody that next Wednesday we'll be doing another show, Voices for Justice, and we have the Helping Heroes in the Fight Against Trafficking with us, folks from all levels of Seroptimus, as well as Polaris Project, and survivors will be speaking out, and they are doing some good work. So join us next Wednesday here at Blog Talk Radio from 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific time. Any last thoughts, Dawn?
Yeah, I want to say a big thank you to Dr. Archer for saying that it's about the way that you look at the future. I always have my own words for how for healing, and that is the day that I learned how to look at the glass half full and not half empty is the day that my life changed and that I was no longer a victim, that I was a survivor. And I completely agree. And for many reasons for myself, I had to address the fact that I had a drug and alcohol addiction problem that lasted well after I got away from John, and until I dealt with that, my healing didn't really begin. So I think I just want to say that there is hope for surviving out of these bad situations, but I think that it's going to take some work, but it's definitely something you can do. And don't quit before the miracle.
Good thoughts, good thoughts. And her links are on our site as well. We will be going over a little bit of our time, so make sure you download this podcast. Glendine, any last thoughts?
Well, I would just like to thank you for letting me share Jessie's story, and you know, check her out. She's on. We got her information on Facebook, and the social network is really active, and there's a lot of missing person sites. I try to get her on as many as I can. And the human trafficking issue has to start with education. We have to start educating ourselves and our homes and our students and the parents and the teachers and then all the frontline workers and the police. And until that's done, the women will no longer be looked, they won't be looked as a prostitute. They'll be looked at as a victim. And when they're looked at as a victim, they will be able to, carry on somewhat in their life. They will be able to hold their head up high and know that it wasn't their fault.
Definitely. And again, you can find more information and updates on the search for Jessie at jessiefoster.ca. And there is, again, a $50,000 reward. So spread the word and let's bring her home. Dr. Archer, any last thoughts?
Well, Michelle, thank you as always for allowing me to be part of this show. I think you do fantastic work, and it's always an honor when you invite me to be on. I just want to say that it all starts with education. And I hear all the time individuals saying, you got to do more, that's not enough, talking about it's not enough. But, I look at the drunk driving statistics just for example. And in 1980, there were 35,000 people that were killed by drunk drivers on American roads. After Mothers Against Drunk Driving got involved and we started educating individuals about drinking and driving, we looked 3 years ago, and that had been cut by two-thirds down to about 12,000. So education is where it starts. You have to understand the problem. You have to talk about the problem over and over and over and over again. And eventually that will get the attention of the legislators and the attention of law enforcement and the attention of the schools and the families and the parents to understand how big this problem is. And I also would like to say that I do write about this on a regular basis on my website, drdalearcher.com, and I would love to get any comments from any folks out there listening. If they would like to hear more, please visit.
Awesome.
Wonderful, wonderful. And again, all of their links are on our site at blogtalkradio.com/helpingheroes. I want to remind everyone also that October 31st is the deadline for the Jane Velez Mitchell Journalism Award. If you know a reporter or journalist making a difference in the lives of women and girls and keeping the victims in the media spotlight, please submit an application for them for that award. Jane will be with us again January 15th at the Oregon Convention Center for the annual Northwest Coalition Against Trafficking Conference, put on by Seroptimus International Northwestern Region. And many people will be here that will educate and inspire you to make a difference in your community on human trafficking. But most importantly, like with what Dawn is doing with Esteem, we'll have Dawn will be there, by the way, at the conference in the Exhibit Resource Expo with Esteem. But we'll also have families of missing children, ways that you can make a difference. And we'll have wonderful breakout sessions and keynote addresses from many people. One in particular is an author named Ann Garrett and Nancy Goodell, who just wrote TLC for the Frazzled Child, or Frazzled Kid, rather. And that is a book to teach children or help children through things that might make them frazzled at times in their lives before they feel the need to run away or go out onto the streets and unfortunately never come home. So there will be a lot of great resources, keynote speakers, and many good friends that will be there to educate, inform, and help protect the victims here in the greater Portland area. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. All of us can be a voice for justice, and I leave you with, what are you doing this week to make a difference? So until we meet again, be the change you wish to see in the world. Please be safe this Halloween, and I say good night. Thank you so much, everyone.
Thank you.
Bye.
Can anybody out there hear my voice? Does anybody out there really care for a missing child? I'm a stranger in a strange place, and I don't know how I got here. I'm so far away from home. I would run, but I'm afraid to, 'cause I don't know what would happen. Could I make it all alone? If I could get someone's attention, one kind soul to look my way.